Native American culture, let's call it. I'm not sure what your expectations are, but I do have some sense that some of you have had some direct experiences with Native American culture, tribal culture, American Indians, what you want to call it. More so than I have. I'll simply briefly indicate that I have been teaching a course on Native American literature and culture off and on for the last 8 years or so. So my interests are primarily literary, and the things that I have brought tonight relate to that most specifically. They reach out beyond that, of course, too. I'm wondering, since there's really a relatively small gathering here, if it would be helpful to simply go around the room and feel welcome to introduce yourself, and if you have had some experience or training or whatnot relating to Native cultures, that you would indicate that to the rest of us, and then perhaps we can decide from there just how we wish to proceed.
Well, I'm Otto Bachman from Kirkwalden, Minnesota, and I really haven't had much to do with Indians at all. I can remember going to Bible camp at Cass Lake, and the burial grounds had little houses over them and a little door, and they said that the Indians would bring food to put on the ledge on these little houses, mm-hmm. you know, for the spirits, for the Indians. But I you know.
So you're here as an interested listener.
Yes.
And I'm Doris Bachman, and I'm an interested listener. I'm at my Danvik, and I'm just an interested listener.
Yeah. I'm Harlan Liso. My wife and I married. I spent 4 years teaching on the Navajo Indian Reservation in Arizona. Mm-hmm.
Did I ask you what you taught there? I don't know.
It was a Bureau of Indian Affairs school. It was elementary school.
I'm Mary.
What did you teach?
Just
in general?
They're fourth, fifth grade Navajo children.
Was that at Rock Point? Or did you
no. We lived at Denahoso, which is not far from Rock Point. We belong to Rock Point Mission.
I just wondered if
mm-hmm.
That's our home church.
Bill Giddings, no direct personal experience.
Roxy Giddings, when I was a little kid, I lived at La Push out on the peninsula out here in Washington, which is an Indian reservation, and just pretty interested in the Indians. I've lived most of my life in this state, and I was born in this state, and my grandpa watched from the cliff what the Indians did when he was a little boy, and taught my dad and mom. They watched, they were at the potlatches when they came in over on Woodley Island. It's just the local Indian around here is pretty interesting to me.
I'm Anne Marie White, and I come from Bellevue. And I actually come from Austria. I'm the only thing I know about Indians, so I saw them in the movies. And since I have been here, I've been on a couple of reservations, and I was very surprised how they really live. You know, it was a big shock to me.
Oh, Zan Eisenhagen, interested listener.
I'm Julie Howard, and I'm from Minnesota, and I go to school in northern Minnesota. It's called Bemidji, and that's kind of the heart of it, Indians of northern Minnesota. So I've had quite a bit of, I don't know, a lot of Indians go to school at Bemidji, so I've gotten up here.
Is it Don Bobineau? Is he the one who heads up the Native American studies up there now?
What was his name?
I'm not sure if it's, is it Bobineau? Does anyone know? I was trying to, someone was asking about it the other day.
It began with B, doesn't it? Friend of John.
Yeah. It's not Bobineau.
What do you call it?
Bobineau?
Something like that. It's very close to that.
Well, he's a friend of Schramm, John Schramm? Yes. Okay, I'll ask him then. Thanks.
I'm Mary Peterson from Bremerton, Washington. I'm Natalie
Joe from Seattle,
Washington. I'm with an interested listener, but I have a friend
for an
Indian. I'd like to find out more about Indian.
I'm Connie Sauter and I taught in, and near Bethel, Alaska, on the Yupik speaking Eskimo since 1946. First in a mission school and now in a public school.
I'm Lulu Reiki, and I guess my childhood was spent in central Wisconsin among the very close to the Winnebago Indians. And I remember my mother telling me, I remember the pathway from the pond back of our house where the Indians still used as the trail. And when mother would bake bread, they'd walk right into the house and take a loaf off the, you know, just walk in and help themselves to a loaf of bread and be on their trail again right back to the house. We lived amongst them, you know, in those early years at least. And I remember them coming to town with their big shawls full of baskets and sitting on our lawn and selling baskets to anybody. I'm just interested.
Did you have a chance?
Yeah, my name is Hope Griffith, and I teach in St. Paul's, and every year I have about 10 students that come from the reservation and live at the Boys Ranch in St. Paul's.
A private footnote, has someone talked to you yet about gathering to plan the forum for Thursday night? The forum on public education? Has anyone talked to you about it yet? Will you see me afterwards? I'm buttonholing teachers.
Leroy Tetris, my name, I'm just interested.
Gordon Creed, mostly interested in listening. We've been raised in northeastern South Dakota with, I guess, with the Sioux. Everybody up there looks down their nose at them, and nobody knows anything about them. Anybody, any farmer, anybody that sees one walking along the road or says, well, here's the reservation Indian, they're just going to town to get their months money to go out and get drunk or something, and nobody really knows anything about the Indians there in that part of the country other than just talk and gossip about them. But then I come from Wichita, and we do have quite a few Indians around Kansas, and we do have a full-time, in my school we have a full-time Indian counselor that does nothing but take care of the Indian high school students and their problems. And we do have a great big Indian center that was built in Wichita. It's quite a tourist attraction. I've never been in it. It cost $1.50 to get in it, so I therefore didn't bother to go. I will sometime later on. And we have Indians in school, but no particular problem.
John Yoder, no problem, no confidence.
I'm Floyd Kubzerk. I'm an Alaska native. And I worked for the Bureau of Indian Affairs for a year in Anchorage, and also Yakima Indian Agency in Toppenish for a year.
And he's on the staff of Holden, and he works in the pot shop.
Right.
See, that's the problem up around northeast and South Dakota. You know, nobody associates, and everybody says something, but nobody knows what they're talking about, basically. Private country, when they're talking about reservation in northeastern South Dakota there, which is too bad. There could be a lot of learning. For instance, everybody's down on the Indians in my August got a flat tire on the road to the lake up there. And he had quite a bit of stuff in the car, and he was worried about it. And all the natives went, all the farmers and everybody else going out to their cabins, like, drove by. Nobody stopped for him. Finally, a couple of the Indians come plugging along, and they stopped, and they helped him fix his tire, and said, well, they're driving to town. And he was really chagrined, because the only people that ever helped him on the road were the Indians. Nobody else would, so he had a different outlook.
If I can avoid sounding as though I'm trying to recruit you, there is a small group that gathers, has been gathering the last couple of afternoons at 4 o'clock up in Chalet No. 9 to talk about specific Indian issues. those issues that receive attention in the newspapers and television occasionally, the kinds of political, public issues that are important for understanding what maybe some of the tensions are in your states or communities. Now, we're using for our discussion this little pamphlet by Duane Addison, who is a religion professor at Augustana College and an ALC school, called Justice for American Indians. It's a brief survey of some past history and a concise listing of a dozen pertinent issues that are on the minds of most Indian tribes today, and then final section, which we'll be dealing with tomorrow, along with anything else we haven't talked about, on our task as church people in relation to justice for Native Americans. So tonight, if I may, I'd like to read a few things from written by Native Americans, a few poems and a couple of prose selections from essays, and then maybe suggest that those of you who've had some direct experience might feel comfortable to break in and relate to perhaps a related story or tale or song or incident that you think seems to fit the general drift of the conversation here. I want to stress that. I think you should feel free to break in, because otherwise I could probably drone on here until vesper time. What I attempted to do was to select a few readings that although they're not flashy or particularly colorful, deal with something very fundamental to Native American culture. Obviously, if you just reflect a minute, you realize, of course, that there is a tremendous diversity among Native American traditions in this country, with some 600 tribal traditions. But I think it's fair to say that there are common threads among the Native American cultures and the expressions of those cultures that are distinctive from Euro-American cultures in the various diversities of our own ethnic backgrounds. The readings I have gathered relate roughly to what I would call the sacred word, and I hope they can do two things. One is to indicate that the spirituality that's evident in all the old Western movies, whenever they have an ancient chief with a craggy face on the screen, that sense of spirituality that is only a kind of thin stereotype of our awareness is something that's deep, that's profound, and is still very much alive among Native American cultures today. I hope that, well, I'm not going to present any kind of dissertation on that, but simply the presence of poetry written by younger Native Americans suggests that. And secondly, that it might permit us to get a perspective on our own religious expressions, perhaps some insight into the Christian faith, by being able to step back, as it were, see some commonality between the kinds of expression of man's relation to God among Native Americans. So we begin with just a couple of short lines by a young woman poet named Paula Allen. It's just an excerpted from a poem of hers. She happens to be, as she identifies herself, a Laguna Pueblo Sioux Lebanese woman. Let me sprinkle pollen over your head. Let me tell the tales that hold the rocks to life. Let me sprinkle pollen over your head. Let me tell the tales that hold the rocks to life. The importance there, at least, of two things, and that is of the stress and the importance of telling, of words, of speech, of verbal communication, of language itself, as the kind of web of the world that seems to hold the rocks, the very rocks, to life. That's evident, of course, in any culture that relies on an oral tradition. There's much more self-conscious awareness of the importance of language. In our culture, we're so inundated with it, so bathed in it continually. I guess not so much at Holden, maybe, but as soon as we step outside, we become unself-conscious of the importance of language in shaping and perpetuating our tradition, our very sense of reality. And then secondly, the sprinkling of the pollen, the communal act of one person to another, a kind of ritual act that may in fact remind you of the sacrament of baptism, which I'll get into here in a minute, suggesting that the importance of language and verbal ritual and enactment, physical enactment of ritual, is a communal thing, very, very important to Native American tribes, and something that we've been talking off and on about in some of our forums and so on. It isn't so evident in Euro-American culture. That is the extreme degree of individualism that simply is not evident among Native American traditions. This paragraph by a Kiowa and one of the best-known Native American writers, Scott Mamaday, from his little book called The Way to Rainy Mountain. It's available, by the way, in the bookstore. A word has power in and of itself. It comes from nothing into sound and meaning. It gives origin to all things. By means of words can a man deal with the world on equal terms. And the word is sacred. A man's name is his own. He can keep it or give it away as he likes. Until recent times, the Kiowas would not speak the name of a dead man. To do so would have been disrespectful and dishonest. The dead take their names with them out of the world. And then in another essay, these comments and a brief tale by Scott Mamaday. When I was a child, my father told me the story of the arrow maker, and he told it to me many times, for I fell in love with it. I have no memory that is older than the hearing of this story, and this is the way it goes. If an arrow is well made, it will have tooth marks upon it. That is how you know. The Kiowas made fine arrows and straightened them in their teeth. Then they drew them to the bow to see that they were straight. Well, once there was a man and his wife, and they were alone at night in their teepee. By the light of a fire, the man was making arrows. After a while, he caught sight of something. There was a small opening in the teepee where two hides had been sewn together. Someone was there on the outside looking in. The man went on with his work, but he said to his wife, "Someone is standing outside. Don't be afraid. Let's talk easily as of ordinary things." He took up an arrow and straightened it in his teeth, and then, as it was right for him to do, he drew it to the bow and took aim, first in this direction and then in that. And all the while he was talking as if to his wife, but this is how he spoke. "I know that you are there on the outside, for I can feel your eyes upon me. If you are a Kiowa, you will understand what I am saying, and you will speak your name." But there was no answer. And the man went on in the same way, pointing the arrow all around, and at last his aim fell upon the place where his enemy stood. He let go of the string. The arrow went straight to the enemy's heart. Mamaday goes on to say, "It is significant that the story of the arrow maker returns in a special way upon itself. The story is about language, after all, and it is therefore part and parcel of its own subject. Virtually, there's no difference between the telling of the tale and that which is told. The point of the story lies not so much in what the arrow maker does, but in what he says. And indeed, that he says it. The principal fact is that he speaks, and in so doing, he places his very life in the balance. He ventures to speak because he must. Language is the repository of his whole knowledge and experience, and it represents the only chance he has for survival. Instinctively and with great care, he deals in the most honest and basic way with words. "Let us talk easily as of ordinary things," he says. And of the ominous unknown, he asks only the utterance of a name, only the most nominal sign that he has understood, that his words are returned to him on the sheer edge of meaning. But there is no answer. The arrow maker knows at once that what he has not known before, that is, that his enemy is there and that he's gained advantage over him. This he knows certainly, and the certainty itself is his advantage, and it's crucial. He makes the most of it. The venture is complete, irrevocable, and ends in success. The story, therefore, is meaningful. Moreover, the story of the arrow maker, as opposed to other stories in general, centers upon this procession of words toward meaning. It seems, in fact, to turn upon the very idea that language involves the elements of risk and responsibility. And in this, it seeks to confirm itself. In a word, it seems to say that everything is a risk, then. That may be true, and it may also be that the whole of literature rests upon that truth. The risk of saying, of communicating in language. Any comments at this time, or reflections on that? Charles Eastman wrote a book called The Soul of the Indian in 1911. It's become a classic among Native American literature in this century. I think it's a kind of defense, a kind of explanation of that which is he felt to be the most significant of his own Lakota Sioux culture at a time when American Indians were receiving little attention other than abuse. In that little book, he has a chapter on what he calls the sacraments, the two sacraments of the Lakota Sioux. The first, the inipe, or the vapor bath, the sweat bath, what we call for us at Holden, the sauna, that he correlates with the sacrament of baptism. And then the ceremony of the pipe, which he correlates with Holy Communion. Both are communal rituals that involve act and word, that involve a physical ritual and a symbolic spiritual meaning. The vapor bath, yes, go ahead.
I was wondering, what was the correlation between the sign and baptism? What was the ritual? Was it like a baptism into their culture?
Yeah. I'll read a few comments about that here in just a minute. He explains that that this combination of the water and the word is an act of purification and a kind of rebirth. In fact, in the Lakota Sioux culture, as he relates it in any case, the myth goes that the first man on earth found himself having to restore the life of his dead younger brother who had been killed by a monster of the deep. In order to do so, he brings the dismembered body of his brother into the sweat lodge, and through that ritual he is made whole and brought back to life. It's interesting, just as a footnote, that the very rocks themselves in the ritual of the inipi, in the sweat bath, the heated rocks over which water is poured, are in a sense sacred. Difficult for us, I think, for Euro-Americans to take that very seriously. Rocks are what get in the way of the plows in the cornfields in Iowa, and they're a tremendous pain. Or rocks are what we carve giant paperweights out of, such as in the Black Hills. And there's some further comments that American Indians have had about that. What some would call desecration of their most sacred land. The ceremony of the pipe is a the use of the breath of man and the multiplicity of the grains of the tobacco combined with fire to form a unity. In fact, at the end of the ceremony, according to Mr. Eastland, the Lakota participants exclaim, "We are all related," suggesting that through the ceremony of the smoking of the pipe, there is this confirmation, affirmation of the union of man with his fellow men and with all of the spirit and physical world around him. In that sense, an act of holy communion, communion of saints. It's interesting to remind ourselves that the word religion means a bringing together, a kind of reunion, a reconciliation.
Is there an initiation rite for that?
For the smoking of the pipe?
Yeah. Is it a certain age that it begins?
That's true, although I think from my readings that varies enough from tribe to tribe that I couldn't really be very certain about when that happens. I'm just not sure. There's so much of variation on those details that it's...
I'm just wondering about what age, did a boy become a man?
When Lame Deer talks about it in his marvelous autobiography, from which I'll read here forthwith, he's about, early teens, 10, 12, that age maybe. So,
yeah.
As I recall. He too was a Lakota. He died just a couple of years ago. Some of you who've done a little reading in Native American literature probably have read Black Elk Speaks by Black Elk, Medicine Man of Lakota Sioux. It was transcribed back in, I think, the 20s or possibly the 30s by John Neihardt, a writer from Nebraska. A similar thing has happened in our own time, so to speak, that is in recent years, that this autobiography by Lame Deer, who is a medicine man also of Lakota Sioux, a native of South Dakota, transcribed by Richard Erdos, an Austrian Jew, who happened, it's an interesting story, and he relates it in the afterword of the autobiography of how he became acquainted with Lame Deer. If you're offended by blunt and direct and salty language, I wouldn't recommend the book, but other than that, it's an absolutely compelling and delightful autobiography, extremely illuminating about contemporary attitudes toward our own culture, our own toward Christianity, and especially revealing some of the religious rituals of the Lakota Sioux tribe. And I want to read a brief passage from that. It's called Lame Deer, Seeker of Visions, and that too is available in the bookstore. No commission. So here we are then, inside the sweat bath, inside this little sticks and bark hut with the hot rocks and the water. The water is ice cold and the stones red hot. So here is a unifying, the earth and the sky, the water of life and the sacred breath of the spirit, grandfather and grandmother coming together. There's a great surge of power. You inhale that breath. Drink in the water, the white steam. It represents clouds, the living soul, life itself. And later he says it heals the wounds of your mind. So this inipi, this sweat bath, is our little church. It is not like some white churches where people sit in pews showing off their fine clothes. Inipi is different. There's no bragging in impurity here, just naked humans huddling in the dark, close to the earth and to the spirit. He says we come out with a feeling of well-being, light-headed and happy. We know that we have done something good which will benefit not only us but all people, all living things. And the little beehive hut, which is so simple to make and which doesn't cost a penny to build, can be used over and over again for the ceremony until it falls apart or the willow sticks which hold it finally break up. In that case, you burn it down, bury the rocks, smoothen the ground, and make the earth whole again. And then you start a new sweat house in another place. And this poem by Phil George, a young Nez Perce Indian poet. It's entitled Old Man, the Sweat Lodge, and it's the opening few lines are in quotation marks. The lodge itself, Old Man, the Sweat Lodge, is speaking to the writer in the Sweat Lodge. The opening few lines are in quotation marks. The lodge itself, Old Man, the Sweat Lodge, is speaking to the writer in the Sweat Lodge. This small lodge is now the womb of our mother, Earth. This blackness in which we sit, the ignorance of our impure minds, these burning stones are the coming of new life. I keep his words near my heart. Confessing, I recall my evil deeds. For each sin, I sprinkle water on fire-hot stones. The hissed steam is sign that the place from which earth seeds grow is still alive. He sweats, I sweat. I remember, old man heals the sick, brings good fortune to one deserving. Sacred steam rises. I feel my pores give out their dross. After I chant prayers to the Great Spirit, I raise the door to the east, and through this door dawns wisdom. Cleansed, I dive into icy waters. Pure, I wash away all of yesterday. Quotation. My son, walk in this new life. It is given to you. Think right, feel right, be happy. I thank you, old man, Sweat Lodge.
Can I ask a kind of an academic question? Did women have sweat lodges, or did they all go together, or was that only something, or is it only something done by the Indian men? I mean, I'm not asking a sexist question. I really don't know.
Again, I would guess that it varies from tribe to tribe. When Lame Deer talks about it, he says that women participated in this. There were some women medicine people. But he said it was unusual. I don't recall his explanation. I think it's a matter of, he himself is, I think, a bit vague about it, tradition. So, yes, maybe you have some insight on it.
Well, I don't know. Have you read Nancy out of
Laverne? Yeah, some of them. He's written a lot of them. Yeah. She is, yeah.
And I asked some of my students about Sue, and they said that he's pretty accurate. And he would talk about white goddesses. You know, that...
Yes.
They were like priestly souls in the ceremony. So maybe that would indicate that, you know, if some of their goddess, some of their priests were in there, and then these white goddesses were called, then perhaps the priests.
Now that you raise that particular issue, I feel almost compelled to indicate that I think most of the Native American peoples would suggest that you mean to talk about goddesses and spirits in the natural creation and so on, that isn't quite the whole story, and that really the understanding of the Great Spirit, which is translated that, really there's no good translation for Wakanta, which is the usual term that's used when this is discussed, the great mystery. It's really a sense of, well, comparable to the word that we have for God, and that when we use the English language to try to understand and interpret, therefore, their understanding of God's presence in creation. And so we use terms like gods and goddesses and spirits and so on that make it sound like it's a pantheistic understanding of the world, that there's a panoply of gods such as in the classical Greek culture, and I don't think that's the case, but that's a very complicated and long issue. It really, again, from my reading, varies so much from tribe to tribe. It's difficult to generalize. What time is Vesper? 7:45?
7:30.
Or 7:30? Anyone know for sure? I guess I could say. 7:45.
Okay. Do you find common patterns among the different types of literature?
Oh, definitely.
Yeah.
Definitely. Yeah. For example, the trickster stories that occur in so many tribal cultures.
But they don't.
Or creation stories that have a high degree of correlation.
But they never had the opportunity to exchange these with each other.
Oh, surely some of them did.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. But you can find, of course, tribes that obviously didn't. Mm-hmm. Similar things. I guess one of the things that I'm suggesting, without my wanting to verbalize it, that there are some universal myths apparent here that we participate in our own expression of the Christian faith. The word and the act, the water and the word, for example, which occurs in, I suppose, in some way, in most profound religious expression.
Yeah.
And I guess I'm uncomfortable saying it, suggesting too, although I don't intend to really get into any detail here, that there's a integrity and great strength and insight in the religious expressions in act and word among Native American cultures that I don't think we have, just bothered to explore very far. You know, we just have these vague ideas of the Great Spirit and the peace pipe and, who's Chief Dan George saying, my heart soars like an eagle, and to Dustin Hoffman in the movie Little Big Man, it just kind of inspires us, but that's as far as we've got, understandably. Maybe I'll just jump to a couple of comments at the end and begin there by, I want to read a short tale about a white man from the Southeast Cheyenne. Read this brief passage first that relates to this aspect of word and symbol and so on. From Lane Deer again. We Sioux spend a lot of time thinking about everyday things, which in our mind are mixed up with the spiritual. We see in the world around us many symbols that teach us the meaning of life. We have a saying that the white man sees so little, he must see with only one eye. We see a lot that you no longer notice. You could notice if you wanted to, but you're usually too busy. We Indians live in a world of symbols and images where the spiritual and the commonplace are one. To you, symbols are just words, spoken or written in a book. To us, they are part of nature, part of ourselves, the earth, the sun, the wind, the rain, stones, trees, animals, even little insects like ants and grasshoppers. And we try to understand them, not with the head, but with the heart. And we need no more than a hint to give us the meaning. What to you seems commonplace, to us appears wondrous through symbolism. This is funny because we don't even have a word for symbolism, yet we're all wrapped up in it. You have the word, but that's all. Mm-hmm. And then this little tale that's entitled The Eye Juggler. It's one that my class delights in. Even though it's, I apologize if you've just eaten. There was a man who could send his eyes out of his head onto the limb of a tree and then call them back again by saying, "Eyes hang upon a branch." A white man saw him do this. And so he came to him crying and he wanted to learn this thing too. So the man taught him, but warned him not to do it more than 4 times in one day. This little tale has something to do with our conversation on self-restraint last night. The white man went off along the river, and when he came to the highest tree that he could see, he sent his eyes to the top. He called them back. Of course, he thought that he could do this as often as he wished, disregarding the warning. The 5th time, his eyes, of course, remained fastened to the limb. All day he called, but the eyes began to swell and spoil. Flies gathered on them. White man grew tired and lay down, facing his eyes, still calling for them, though of course they never came, and he cried. At night, when he was half asleep, a mouse ran over him. He closed his lids that the mice might not see him that he was blind, and he lay still in order to catch one. At last, one little mouse sat on his breast, and he kept quiet to let it become used to him, and then the mouse crawled onto his face, trying to cut his hair for the nest. And it licked his tears, but it let its tail hang in his mouth, and so he closed it and caught the mouse, seized it tightly, and made it guide him and told him of his misfortune. Well, the mouse said it could see the eyes. They had swelled to an enormous size. He even offered to climb the tree and get them for him, but of course the white man would not let him go, suspicious as he was. The mouse tried to wriggle free, but the white man held him fast. Then the mouse asked on what condition that he would release it. The white man said, only if it gave him one of its eyes. So the mouse gave him one of his own eyes. And the white man could see again and let the mouse go. But of course, the small eye was far back in his socket, and he couldn't see very well with it. Now, a buffalo was grazing nearby, and as white man stood near him, crying, of course, the buffalo looked on him and wondered what was going on. The white man said, "Here is a buffalo. He has the power to help me in my trouble." And so the buffalo asked him what he wanted, and the white man told him that he'd lost his eye and he needed another one. So the buffalo took out one of his eyes and put it in the white man's head. Now white man could see far again. The eye did not fit the socket. Most of it was outside. And the other, of course, was far inside. Thus, he remained. Something about sight and insight. What do you say, Lloyd or Lisa? Do you have any comments or contributions? I brought with me the Navajo benediction, if we can call it that, the beauty way, a translation of the beauty way. Isn't that a marvelous song? You can probably sing it, can you? Huh? That's a beautiful thing. I was thinking of saving it for our Friday foot feet. We have a special foot day in celebration of feet and holding. There's some lines in here that fit that very well. House made of dawn, house made of evening light, house made of dark cloud, house made of male rain, house made of dark mist, house made of female rain, house made of pollen, house made of grasshoppers, dark cloud is at the door. The trail out of it is dark cloud. The zigzag lightning stands high upon it. Male deity, your offering I make. I have prepared a smoke for you. Restore my feet for me. Restore my legs for me. Restore my body for me. Restore my mind for me. Restore my voice for me. This very day, take out your spell for me. Your spell remove for me. You have taken it away from me. Far off it has gone. Happily I recover. Happily my interior becomes cool. Happily I go forth. My interior feeling cool, may I walk. No longer sore, may I walk. Impervious to pain, may I walk. With lively feelings, may I walk. As it used to be long ago, may I walk. Happily may I walk. Happily with abundant dark clouds, may I walk. Happily with abundant showers, may I walk. Happily with abundant plants, may I walk. Happily on a trail of pollen, may I walk. Happily may I walk. Being as it used to be long ago, may I walk. May it be beautiful before me. May it be beautiful behind me. May it be beautiful below me. May it be beautiful above me. May it be beautiful all around me. In beauty, it is finished. That's nice, isn't it?